So, good afternoon, friends. I hope you're feeling well and at ease. I'm settling in to the rhythm of retreat. I'm going to offer some thoughts about Vipassana, insight meditation. And there are a few people who are new to retreat. And so I just want to say a few words before that about listening to a Dharma talk. It's a little different than listening to a lecture. And you know, usually that's what's closest. If you're not used to listening to Dharma talks, that's what we may associate, that we're listening to the ideas and the mind is comparing ideas and seeing how things fit together with other things that we know. And so the mind is very active in the process of listening to, you know, kind of an academic lecture or a talk. And a Dharma talk is different, or there's an invitation to listen differently. To listen more holistically from the body. So it doesn't matter if you don't remember, you know, most of the talk. Maybe there are a few phrases or an idea that you connect with and that awakens something in you that invites you to look a little bit differently or experience a little bit differently. It can become part of how you then, you know, understand what practice is about. So that's the offering is made in that spirit of an invitation to listen and to see what's useful for you and see what resonates for you. This practice that we're doing is called insight meditation. Insight is a translation of a Pali word. The word insight, I don't think, exists in French. So it's another phrase. Something profond.
Vision profonde.
Vision profonde. So that's actually, I think, close to the sense of the Pali word, perhaps a bit more than insight, which we tend to think of in a psychological way. So seeing deeply is a sense of the Pali word vipassana. Seeing deeply, what are we seeing deeply into? We're seeing deeply into the nature of our experience, the nature of our lives, and the insight it's pointing to what brings us to be free from the patterns of suffering, the patterns, habitual patterns of experiencing ourselves and our lives that we're caught up in, which perpetuates suffering. So it's an insight that brings us toward more freedom, more joy, more happiness, more love. And specifically, it's an insight into the characteristics that the Buddha says are present in every experience that we can have through the senses. So that's most of our experience. So seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and mental factors, what arises in the mind by way of thoughts and perceptions. So, so we develop this capacity for insight through the practice of mindfulness, sati. And sati has within it, within the practice, there's the cultivation of collectedness of the mind, so a steadiness of the mind, because the ordinary mind, what the Buddha called the untrained mind, is scattered, is pulled all over the place by our experiences, by our thoughts, by our perceptions, by our beliefs. And so we develop a capacity for collectedness or steadiness of the mind, which is able to connect moment by moment with what arises and passes away. And so mindfulness is that moment by moment awareness. So that samatha, the collectedness, and the sati together create this capacity to see deeply into our experience. And so what the Buddha suggests, you know, so the Buddha always says, look and see for yourself. Don't believe me. Don't just believe it because I say it, or because somebody tells you, or because you read it somewhere, or because you think you're supposed to believe it. But look and see, is this your experience? And so what the Buddha is inviting us to look at is that everything is continuously changing. So the Pali word is anicca. It's impermanent. There's nothing that persists even for a moment. It's everything is in the process of changing. Because of that, when we try to hold on to something that we think, because the delusion is we think things exist in a certain way, and we think that they, so the illusion is that things are permanent, and then we think that we can hold on to them, and so that's what creates dukkha, which is the second mark of our experience, the second mark of everything that we can experience through the senses. So those two are very closely linked. And then a third one, which is also closely linked, is the characteristic of anatta, which has been translated as not-self or non-self. And so we have the illusion that things are separate and there's a solid, permanent core to our own being, our own self, that we exist as a self, and that the things around us that we can experience exist as selves or separate objects. So this way of seeing things really objectifies the world around us. So if I'm the self at the center of my experience, then everything is an object of my experience. So it creates a kind of a duality in everything that we experience. So this this observing, this capacity to be present with, observing. And words are they're not perfect to describe the kind of experience that we're orienting ourselves toward, because even observing creates a sense of self and other. So cultivating this quality of sustained attention, stability of attention, without judging, without preferring, without getting caught up in our stories about how we relate to this or that, it's really cultivating a new way of being. It's a way of cultivating a very spacious way of being, in which we aren't defining ourselves or defining others in relation to ourselves. So this this quality of attention brings us into a relationship with our experience of really allowing things to be as they are and not knowing, not defining. And in the Zen tradition, that quality of being with experience in a way that doesn't define, that doesn't know, that doesn't label, that is just interested and open and spacious, is pointed at very frequently. And there's a beautiful saying by Zen Master Dogen, Soto, the founder of the Soto Zen school of practice, in which he talks about not knowing as the deepest intimacy. Not knowing is great intimacy. Because when I don't label, this person as whatever my perception is, my judgment is, but I can just be curious and open and interested in how that moment by moment experience is unfolding, it creates a capacity or a potential for a mutuality of experience to emerge. So each moment can be new. Each moment can be just this. So this is a kind of a practice. It's challenging to our ordinary way of living, that we have ways of describing things and classifying things and categorizing things, and really to live with a sense of not knowing and feeling an openness to what is emerging is not something that's well supported in our society. We're supposed to have an opinion about everything, right? We're supposed to we're supposed to be for or against, you know, this or that. And it's not that we can't discern that some things truly are harmful and other things truly are beneficial. But we don't need to label the people who live around us as this or that, but perhaps just allow what is emergent to be known. So talking about, I think I've been talking in a way that's a little bit abstract. So let me talk a little bit about each one of these characteristics. One of the quotes from Joseph Goldstein that I remember, and it's very simple and direct, is that not seeing impermanence is ignorance, and seeing impermanence is the doorway to wisdom. So when we look around and we think that everything is solid and permanent, including ourselves, we're deluded. And then when we see things changing, we become destabilized or feel that it shouldn't be changing. But actually, it never was permanent. The Buddha said that it's better to live a single day seeing impermanence than 100 years without seeing it. And he also said that it's better to see one moment of the truth of arising and passing away than years and years of practice of generosity and loving kindness and service, all of these things which are a great benefit, but to have insight into one moment of rising and passing away is of greater value for our liberation than all of those. So when we sit in meditation and we get caught up in our stories, the story about me, the story about another, how solid can that feel sometimes? You know, like whatever it is, you know, my neighbor, my boss, my kid, you know, is this or is that? And those, we can feel so stuck in those stories sometimes. And they feel so solid. And if we can just allow ourselves to have some space around the story of, this is terrible, or this is wonderful, and just be with the unfolding of it and the not knowing of it. Then we can live in a way that's not caught in grasping and resisting our experience in each moment. I've heard this story attributed to many different traditions, to a Taoist tradition, to a Jewish tradition to a Chinese tradition. Anyway, it's a story in which, you know, it kind of exemplifies the not knowing, the bringing that quality of not knowing into our lives. So there was this farmer who lived with his son. He was widowed. He was a widower. And he one day a horse, so they were living in the country and they were on this this farm and a horse appeared. So it must have been a wild horse. It came and you know, kind of attached itself to their fields and the boy the son began to have a relationship with this horse and train the horse and the neighbors said to the farmer, yeah, that's really wonderful that your son has this horse now to its companion, and so it's consoling him since his mother died, and the farmer said, perhaps, and then the horse ran off, and the neighbor said, oh, what a shame that the horse has run off now, and this companion your son had is no longer there. And the farmer said, perhaps. And then that horse came back with some other horses. And so the neighbor said, wow, that's really great. You know, that now you have a few horses and maybe you can, you know, start a herd and it could be part of supporting how you're supported in your livelihood and your farming. And the farmer said, perhaps. And then as the son was trying to train one of the new horses that arrived, he fell off that horse and he was thrown and he broke his leg. And the neighbors said, oh, that's terrible. Now your son is going to be incapacitated. And of course, this was a story from ancient times, very hard to set a leg so that it could heal properly. And, you know, there was, of course, a chance that this boy would always have a limp or, you know, not be able to walk as easily, and so the neighbors commiserated and said, oh, that's, you know, such a shame that this happened. And of course, what did the farmer say? Perhaps. And then the king came and sent his soldiers. The king sent his soldiers around because he wanted to go fight against another realm, and they were pressing into service all the young men of the area, but then when they came to the farmer's son, they saw he was incapacitated because he had his a leg that was broken, and of course the people said, oh wow, aren't you lucky that he has this injury. And then, of course, the farmer says, perhaps. So, and so on. And so, can we not seize upon how things are with the mind and create a sense of, this is how it should be, this is how I want it to be, this is how it must be, and recognize that that everything is evolving and everything is changing. I think, you know, some of us being of elder years,
yeah,
have we learned that in our lives. If we allow life to teach us, we recognize that the intentions, the goals, the desires that we had for our lives don't work out exactly as we wanted, and maybe along the way we can learn something, become wiser, become more allowing of life to unfold as it is. And so this is the deepening of wisdom, the doorway to wisdom that is impermanence. And it is the it is the way that impermanence can teach us to release that hold, that grasping that things must be a certain way. And it can lead to a profound shift in the way we experience life. This illusion of control, this illusion of stability, and it's kind of like, when we get lost in stories, it's kind of like when we're watching a movie, and we get so drawn into that story, and we forget that it's just a play of light and shape on the screen in the movie, and so just having that, training the mind and deepening in the wisdom that comes from seeing impermanence and not grasping at things being a certain way, there's a word that is used in Buddhist teaching called disenchantment. And disenchantment is often used to express like something like I become disenchanted with somebody because I see, their shadow side, or I see that I thought that they were such a wonderful person, and I see that they are flawed, they have feet of clay, and so on. But actually, disenchantment is in Buddhism is it's a quality, it's an insight, it's a deepening of insight that we develop through the deeply seeing into impermanence, and we become disenchanted with the illusions that we're going to find any lasting fulfillment, any ultimate fulfillment from what we experience through the body and mind, through our senses. It's not that it's not beautiful, and our hearts can't be open to the beauty and the life around us. But when we hold on to it and we want it to be a certain way, when we think that we can control it and keep it in some way, that's what causes suffering. And when we deepen in disenchantment, leads to the wisdom of relinquishment, of letting go, which is very, very close to the wisdom of awakening, of complete letting go. And letting go moment by moment is letting be, letting go and letting be, letting life be as it is. And the third characteristic, anatta, or anatta, I think is probably the correct Pali pronunciation. Is this seeing into these meditations that we're doing this week on the elements are one of the ways that we see into the non-self nature of being, that we are. Who we are we constantly changing causes and conditions. So we are the conditions of the five elements arising and passing away in this body and in internally and externally. We are the causes and conditions of perceptions, conditioned perceptions. I'll talk a little bit more about them in the next couple of days. And mental formations, ways that we've been conditioned to think, to label, to believe. So all of these are constructed, and we think that they are me, we think that they're mine, we think that they are who we are. So anatta is pointing to the truth that it's not, some people misunderstand anatta the teaching on non-self to think that it means we don't exist. So that's not what it's pointing to. But anatta is pointing to that we are not the separate, enduring self that we imagine ourselves to be. So and we, one of the ways that we create a sense of self is that we identify with our subjectivity. So the subject of, you know, in within which we experience the arising of seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and thinking. Kind of the center of life, the center of the universe. We each of us is kind of this. To the extent that we are living in delusion, we each think that we're the center of the universe, and everyone else is out there, right? And so there is a way in which, you know, that objectifies the life around us and denies the subjectivity, not only of other human beings and other forms of life, but also all the manifestations of life. So the tree meditation, if you played with that at some time earlier today. So it's not that to imagine or to project that a tree has subjectivity in the same way that you or I do, but there is some quality of experiencing that a tree has. A tree, the life of a tree is some kind of experience, which is maybe, you know, beautifully mysterious to us. And we're learning about how trees communicate through the roots and the fungi, and, you know, and how they warn other trees in the forest about, you know, the invasion of different harmful insects or diseases and so on. And they can build up defenses because of that. So it's we have perceptions of the way things are that blind us to the mystery and the intelligence, the incredible intelligence of the life around us. There are some theologians who are at the kind of pioneers back 20, 30, 40 years ago in eco-spirituality, Thomas Berry and Teilhard de Chardin, familiar with him, and Matthew Fox, some of you may have heard of him. And I was, as I was kind of just exploring about contemplations on water. I came across this piece of writing by Jay McDaniel called The Process Worldview. And I'm going to read it, and we'll end with that. It's very much in alignment, I think, with what I've been just talking about with Anicca Dukkha Anatta, this process worldview. Every moment in a person's life is an act of improvisation, creating something new out of a settled past. Improvisation goes all the way down into the depths of matter. It's really interesting. When we think of the evolving universe, and if we can think of it as just a process of continual improvisation to create new forms. Improvisation goes all the way down into the depths of matter. We live in a universe of interbecoming. Each event in the universe carries the influence of and influences all the others. The building blocks of the universe are moments and relationships, not things. Each and every living being is a subject of its own life and not just an object for others. A subject with intrinsic value. Injustice lies in denying the value of other lives, other subjects, and it harms all involved. Injustice lies in denying the value of other lives, other subjects, and it harms all involved. our human calling is to enjoy life as best we can and to help build communities that are creative, compassionate, participatory, multicultural, humane to animals and good for the earth, with no one left behind. As we seek to fulfill this vocation, we are beckoned by the ideal of beauty, harmony, and intensity of experience. Sensitivity to beauty includes awe and wonder, zest for life, love, and meaning-making. This ideal of beauty and its inwardly felt beckoning toward the fullness of life for each and all is how deep listening of the universe is present continuously in life on earth and the entirety of the cosmos. So I left out a word when I read that sentence, so I'll read it again with the word that I left out. And just be with it lightly, because see how it is with you. This ideal of beauty and its inwardly felt beckoning toward the fullness of life for each and all is how deep listening of the universe, God, is present continuously in life on earth and the entirety of the cosmos. So we can perhaps let words again evoke something new and maybe new understandings of sacredness, the sacred dimension of being that I spoke about earlier, how that sacred dimension, when we include that in how we understand the life around us, it brings us closer to our deepest self, because that sacredness is alive in every part of what we can experience internally and externally. And both together, internally and externally. So let's just take a few minutes to sit and breathe together. Bringing this quality of openness of heart, of love, of caring and connection to all of life. Water is alive. The earth is alive.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.